Das Politikteil, der wöchentliche Politik-Podcast von Zeit und Zeit Online.
Marc, es ist doch wirklich gruselig, oder?
Was meinst du?
Naja, ich weiß nicht, wie es dir ging, aber die vergangenen Wochen standen für mich, ganz mal abgesehen von den Sorgen um Corona und Lockdown, sehr unter dem Eindruck der US-Wahl. Mit der Frage, ob Donald Trump, nachdem er das höchste Amt der Welt in einer wirklich sehr seltsamen Weise ausgefüllt hat, die man ja eigentlich nie für möglich gehalten hätte, noch einmal gewählt werden würde. Ich weiß nicht, wie es dir ging, Marc. Ich glaube, ich spreche für uns beide und wahrscheinlich für viele hier in Deutschland und wahrscheinlich auf der ganzen Welt. Wir hatten darauf gehofft, dass Biden einen Erdrutschsieg hinlegen würde. Und was kam dann? Zittern bis zur letzten Minute. Ein Präsident, der das Wahlergebnis anfechten wollte, bevor es überhaupt da war. Und Proteste von Anhängern Trumps, die verhindern wollten, dass alle Stimmen bis zum Schluss ausgezählt werden. Das ist doch eigentlich unglaublich, oder?
Na, ich glaube, was uns einfach in den letzten 48 Stunden, und man muss dazu sagen, es ist jetzt Donnerstag, wir zeichnen diesen Podcast am Donnerstag auf, was uns in den letzten 48 Stunden klar geworden ist, ist einfach, dass die Probleme in den USA viel tiefer wurzeln, als nur in womöglich den letzten 4 Jahren der Amtszeit von Donald Trump, dass sehr viel auch bleibt von Donald Trump, selbst wenn Trump weg sein sollte.
Willkommen beim Politikteil. Mein Name ist Eliana Grabitz. Ich bin Politikchefin von Zeit Online in Berlin.
Und ich bin Marc Prost. Ich bin einer der Politikchefs der gedruckten Zeit, ebenfalls aus Berlin.
Ja, wir wollen heute einige große Fragen besprechen. Wie kann es sein, dass in einem Land wie den USA so viele Menschen einen Mann unterstützen, der gar keinen Hehl daraus macht, dass er Rassist ist und die Demokratie missachtet? Was haben die Demokraten falsch gemacht, dass sie noch nach 4 Jahren Chaos rund um die Regierung Trump keinen Erdrutschsieg hingelegt haben? Wie gespalten sind die Vereinigten Staaten wirklich? Und natürlich wollen wir auch den Blick in die Zukunft werfen. Was muss passieren, um die Gräben in der amerikanischen Gesellschaft zu schließen?
Es sind ganz schön große und gewichtige Fragen und vor allem um die letzte soll es gehen, die Gräben in der amerikanischen Gesellschaft, die gespaltene Gesellschaft, die jetzt wieder geeint werden muss. Wie kann das eigentlich gelingen? Und ich freue mich, dass wir da mit jemandem drüber reden, der ganz nah dran ist am Geschehen, der ein paar Jahre weg war aus den USA, aber jetzt dort wieder ist und der uns sehr viel sagen kann über die USA, über Joe Biden, aber ein bisschen auch über Deutschland.
Ja, das ist John Emerson. Er war von 2013 bis 2017 Botschafter in Berlin. Damals war Barack Obama noch in seiner zweiten Amtszeit im Oval Office. Eine Zeit, in der, glaube ich, es auch um die transatlantischen Beziehungen sehr anders aussah als heutzutage. Und Herr Emerson gehörte im Übrigen auch zu den Botschaftern, die von Donald Trump als einer seiner ersten Amtshandlungen abgerufen wurden, damals kurz nachdem er ins Oval Office eingezogen war. Hello, Mr. Emerson.
Hello, Eliana. Good to be with you. Good to be with you, Mark, as well.
Ja, Herr Emerson, Sie haben ja, wie schon gesagt, 4 Jahre in Deutschland gelebt und sprechen daher eigentlich auch Deutsch. Sie haben aber darum gebeten, dass wir dieses Gespräch auf Englisch führen. Und dieser Bitte wollen wir auch nachkommen. Daher, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, würden wir jetzt zum Englischen rüber switchen, wie man so schön sagt. Well, Mr. Emerson, like any guest here on our podcast, we ask you to bring along a special noise that leads us to the topic of our conversation. The sound, so to say, that it's linked to what we are talking about today.
Well, my noise would be, and that's because Joe Biden is knocking on the door of the presidency.
All right. Mr. Emerson, I'm sure you have had some exciting hours and days too, like us here in Germany, waiting for the results of the US elections. Did you expect that it was going to be such a close run in the end?
Actually, I did. I've been saying for months that the election would be much closer than the polls suggested. We're a very divided nation. 5 out of our last 6 presidential elections have been extremely close in 2 of them. And there's still the possibility that in a third, the loser of the popular vote won the Electoral College. And precisely because the states that Trump won the last time were so narrowly won, and because the polls in the swing states always showed, for the most part, that Trump and Biden were within the margin of error of those polls, I'm not at all surprised that it's taking so long. The other piece that people may not understand is this whole idea of mail-in ballots. What happened is because of the COVID crisis, more than half of Americans voted by mail this year. Normally, it's about 20%. And what happens with a mail-in ballot is because the person is not coming to the polls and can't present themselves and show a photo identification at the polls, there has to be a check to make sure that the person voting is in fact the mail, you know, the registered voter. And so what happens is they typically have to sign the outside of the envelope, and then that signature needs to be physically compared to the signature that the person used when they registered to vote in the first place, or when they requested the mail-in ballot in the first place. And that takes time. And they're literally right now, and as we're recording this, there's 700,000 mail-in ballots yet to be counted in Illinois. There's 450,000 mail-in ballots yet to be counted in Arizona. And there's about 200,000 mail-in ballots yet to be counted in Nevada. And you can imagine every single one of those, somebody has to physically compare before they even count them. And we knew this was going to be the case, particularly in some of these swing states. So that's why I'm not surprised it's taking so long.
I think a lot of Democrats are hurt tonight. I think there's a lot of hurt out there. There's a moral victory and there's a political victory. They're not the same. They're not the same thing. The political victory still may come. But I think for people who saw babies being snatched away from their mothers at the border, for people who are sending their kids into schools where the N-word is now being used against them, for people who have seen this wave of intolerance, they wanted a moral victory tonight. We wanted to see a repudiation of this direction for the country. And the fact that it's this close, I think, It hurts. It just hurts.
The person we have just heard, Mr. Emerson, was Van Jones, a political commentator, and he sounded very disappointed, as if he was feeling very down. Tell us about your own feelings. What are you feeling like these days?
Well, I think a lot of Democrats were hoping that not only would Joe Biden win, but that there, as Van Jones said, there would be in effect a repudiation of what they've seen over the last 4 years, and in particular, that could lead to the Democrats taking control of the Senate. So, one party rule in our government, and that absolutely did not happen. I felt that was a bit of a bridge too far. I felt it was possible, maybe even plausible that that might happen. But I put the blue wave scenario at about one third and a very, very super close election at about two thirds of likelihood. But, you know, I can certainly understand what Van Jones is saying and certainly understand why he feels that way. I think it's a mistake, though, to assume that people who voted for Donald Trump were in effect endorsing the kinds of behaviors that that Van Jones was talking about. I think there are a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump who don't like that behavior and are repulsed by it. But whether it was because of their sense that Donald Trump would be better on the economy, or whether it was because of the sense that particularly for people in rural America, I think there's a sense that Donald Trump understands them and speaks for them, and that the Democratic Party has moved to become a party that really reflects the view of elites in America. And there is a little bit of poking the eye in the elites, I think, that was reflected in this election as well.
So we will talk about all these reasons during the podcast later. Just to talk about you, what is it that moves or touches you at the moment? What are your feelings?
Well, I've lived through this quite a few times. I ran for office myself and lost by 31 votes for the Landtag of California back in 1991. And it was 2,000 votes that had yet to be counted. It took 2 weeks to count them. And I ended up coming on the short end of the stick by 31 votes. As a friend of mine said at the time, when you walk into a room with 16 people, you must be really pissed off. But you know, so, and then of course I lived through, Bush v. Gore and the, you know, 6 week recount, in that state. At that time, I was the chairman of Gore's campaign in California. California was pretty solidly for Al Gore, but obviously all the focus and attention was on Florida. But that's another one. And I guess my my feeling is anxiety, nervousness as we're watching this. I think it truly still could go either way. I'd rather be in Joe Biden's shoes than Donald Trump's right now, because I do think things are trending in Biden's directions. But this is going to be an extremely close election. My guess is there'll be lawsuits. My guess is there'll be recounts. Mm-hmm. And but my belief is that for sure we will have it resolved by mid-December when the Electoral College actually has to meet. But yeah, I would say anxiety and fatigue and a sense of deja vu.
And what frightens you exactly now in this situation?
Much frightens me, but I think that putting on my hat as the chairman of the American Council on Germany, I'm deeply concerned about the future of the transatlantic relationship. And I think we've seen a pulling away and a fraying of that over the last 4 years. And certainly would be very concerned about that continuing for 4 more years. And I think you'd see quite a different approach taken by a Biden administration in terms of that. So that concerns me. I think that a lot of people, you know, my kids are now and my daughters are very familiar to a lot of Germans because they of our time in Germany as ambassador, watching our identical twins grow up, and they were musicians and wrote a play that and songs that, you know, Morgan Magazine and other places broadcast. So they got to be pretty well known. But the fact is they're in their 20s. But I worry for families in America who have young children, and they see the behavior that gets exhibited in our politics and wonder if, well, that's maybe the way to behave if you want to be successful. And, you know, it's okay to be a bully. It's okay to brag. It's okay to insult people. And that's not the kind of behavior I think we want to have our children see. And then I think the third area is I worry about young people in Germany who this really defines their view of the United States. We did a poll recently with American Council on Germany and Atlantic Brücke, which is our sister organization. And that poll suggested that while 80-85% of Americans have very, very positive views of Germany, 80-85% of Germans have very negative views of America, in part because of what they're seeing from our leadership. And that troubles me as well.
A last question about your feelings, or perhaps the feelings of Joe Biden. Did you, or have you already spoken to Joe Biden since Tuesday?
No, I haven't. I've spoken to a number of people at senior levels of his campaign, including his campaign chairman and senior advisor and some other folks as well. But I haven't spoken to him. I have texted with my good friend Kamala Harris, who's the vice presidential nominee. But you know, my feelings about Joe Biden is he is just such a decent, empathic, caring human being that I think he may be the right person. I think he is the right person at this point to try to start to heal the divisions that exist in our country.
And what did Kamala Harris say on the phone when you talked to her?
Oh, she sent me a heart emoji back.
Okay.
Well, believe me, these folks are so overwhelmed and swamped right now that, you know, I'm sure she's getting, they're all getting lots of emails and texts and whatnot from friends around the world. So it's, I didn't expect anything more than that.
Yeah. It's so interesting what you said about the image we Germans might have of America, because, you know, I've got 3 daughters as well. And my youngest daughter, she's now 7. I remember when she was 4 years old or 5, she already knew the name of Donald Trump, you know, and she knew that he was a bad man. And this is then the image she's growing up with of America. But let's move to another question. You are a member of the Democratic Party, and of course, this is what you said before, you are also a supporter of Joe Biden. But we would like to start by changing the perspectives now and talk a little bit about your feelings regarding Donald Trump. What would you say? Is there anything around him that you like? Anything that you appreciate looking back at the past 4 years?
Yeah, I think I honestly think you have to give Donald Trump, and I would add Bernie Sanders to this, a lot of credit for recognizing the fact that there are a whole lot of Americans who do feel that they've been forgotten, who do feel that the rapid pace of globalization, technology revolution, and all that has really left them behind and are feeling out to sea because of these changes in the world and changes in their lives. And they're scared. And I think that both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in their campaigns in 2016 put a real spotlight on that. And I think that was that's hugely valuable and hugely important. And if I also have a sense that Joe Biden understands that. And if he's fortunate enough to win this election, he's not going to forget that or ignore those folks, and recognizes the need that we need to, you know, address those real systemic problems that exist in our society that aren't necessarily just focused on the urban areas. So I think that's one thing. I think the second thing is, a lot of people I know in Germany were quite off put by the emphasis on burden sharing, Nord Stream 2, that kind of thing. It's important for people to remember those issues were initially raised by Barack Obama. I mean, that started during the Obama administration. The difference is that I think they were raised to a higher decibel in the Trump administration, and almost to the point where it appeared that that was the only thing that was important about our relationship. And I think what you would see with a Joe Biden presidency is sort of a return to what we had under Obama in the sense that our relationship is much broader and deeper than the two or three areas where we may have conflict or disagreement, and our relationship would be much more defined by the areas we share in common, our common values, our shared concern about issues like climate change, nuclear proliferation, how to deal with all the displaced people in the world, the potential of climate refugees, dealing with transnational terrorism, all those things that we've been working on together from a core basis of shared values will define the relationship. But it doesn't mean our areas of dispute would go away. So I would give Trump credit for continuing to put those on the front pages of the papers, you know, of our allies, and keep them first front of mind. But I would be critical of not having emphasized the areas that we have in common as well. And then the third thing is, I do think in the area of trade and China, I think there's been a recognition that President Trump has certainly articulated that our trade relationships cannot simply be about embracing globalization and assuming that the increased prosperity from free and fair trade will just lift all boats. Because guess what? A lot of boats weren't lifted by that. And by the way, I think you all see this in Germany with that. Just think about what is the core or the source of the energy that drives AFD as an example. And so in any event, I think recognizing that as we negotiate future trade agreements, we need to pay attention to truly leveling the playing field and not hurting, in our case, the American worker, but creating more opportunities for the American worker, and not just simply saying, hey, your jobs are going to go away, learn to be a healthcare worker or learn to be a technician, which is kind of what the approach had been in the past. And then on China, the Trump administration has, represented a sharp departure from what had been a 50-year bipartisan consensus in both Democratic and Republican administrations, where the point of view was, well, the more we engage with China, the more they will become like us in terms of adherence to rule of law and, transparency in commercial transactions and financial reporting and on and on. And I think the, Trump administration is, given voice to the reality, which is now, I think, widely shared on a bipartisan basis and in the business community, that simply is not going to happen. And we need to take a different and more clear-eyed approach in terms of dealing with China. That doesn't mean that decoupling is the right answer. It doesn't mean that should look at this as a new Cold War. But it does mean that we ought to treat China as a very fierce competitor and potentially an adversary. And I think you have to give the Trump administration credit for sort of moving us in that direction as well.
So these were long and many credits to the Trump administration. I think we have to keep it in mind if we talk about the future of international relationships and international relations and our relations in Germany to China. But just to stay a few more minutes at the outcome of the election, in an interview that you gave in a German magazine at the beginning of the corona crisis in the spring of this year, you said this election would be 100% about how Trump would cope with corona. Why did things turn out differently?
Well, I think for a lot of voters, it was 100% on how he coped with corona, and he got very negative marks for it. But I think he was, you know, maybe what I underestimated was his skill and success at sort of dividing the nation into or exploiting the division between. Well, let me put it this way. Creating a sense that there was actually you had to make a choice between keeping your job and having the economy continue to grow and fighting the corona crisis. And in fact, that's a false choice. In fact, you can do both together. And in fact, you can't really get the economy growing again until you deal effectively with the corona crisis. And I think what Donald Trump was very effective in doing, and this is a political, you know, analytical statement here. It's not a value statement. But what he was effective in doing was getting his supporters to focus first and foremost on the economy. So one of the most interesting exit poll analyses I saw showed that the top two issues of concern for Biden voters were number one, COVID, and number two, racial injustice. And the top two concerns for Trump voters were number one, the economy, and number two, law and order, which was sort of the reverse play that, again, Trump was pushing, you know, as a political matter to the protests that we saw in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. So I think that's, you know, the area where I was wrong on that was I think I underestimated the extent to which he would be successful in convincing people that, you know, set COVID aside and let's focus on the economy. And, you know, but at this point, you know, it looks like Joe Biden will win by 4 to 5 million popular votes. So I think from that standpoint, it was probably a correct statement. And I do think the one segment of voters that Donald Trump won overwhelmingly in 2016 against Hillary Clinton were seniors. People 65 and older, he won that by 9 points. In this election, Biden won seniors by 1 point, 1%. That's a 10% swing. And I would bet you dollars to donuts that is almost entirely a function of the seniors' concern that the Trump administration was not serious about or effective in dealing with COVID.
So, Mr. Emerson, you have just said that Joe Biden was actually right in putting a lot of emphasis on corona. And in fact, he's really strong in doing so. And he's strong in showing some empathy as well, very contrary to Mr. Trump, who was suffering from corona himself, but didn't really have an empathic way of dealing with that. But you also said that Mr. Trump profited from setting a lot of emphasis on the economy. What do you think? Should Joe Biden have put more emphasis on the economy and then everything would have been all right too?
I don't know if everything would have been all right, but I must say my reaction coming out of the Democratic convention was I think they could have done more to emphasize the fact that Joe Biden and Barack Obama had to really rebuild the economy after the global financial crisis. I mean, they inherited a disaster. And you know, this economy is obviously suffering greatly. In some metrics, it's suffering more than it did during the global financial crisis. But in the global financial crisis, we honestly didn't know how it would end. In this one, we actually do know how it will end. It will end when we have a widely disseminated vaccine that allows people to comfortably, you know, get back to work and resume their lives in a way that, you know, pretty closely approximates the way we were living our lives pre-COVID. There'll be some changes, obviously, but that's, you know, that's fundamentally how it will end. We just don't know precisely when it will end. I think that most people assume sometime in 2021, but it was much worse back in 2008, 2009 after the Obama-Biden election, and Joe Biden was basically put in charge of trying to help rebuild the economy, in particular, save the American auto industry, which ended up being a very, very successful effort. And I thought they probably could have made more of that. But, you know, the problem in a campaign is you can't have too many messages going on. You know, you have to sort of decide what is the principal choice that you want voters to have in mind when they go into the polls. And so I think that's why, you know, obviously both campaigns did that. And that's that those were the choices that were made. So it would probably have been harder to put such an emphasis on COVID and empathy and bringing the country together, or whatever. And oh, yes. And by the way, on the economy. So I think that, you know, I'm not an insider of the Biden campaign. I'm, you know, the role that I play now is much more sort of analyzing what's happening and trying to project what will happen in the event of either one of them getting elected in terms of policy development, impact on the markets, that kind of thing. So, so I wasn't there, but my guess is that was part of the consideration, during the campaign.
But John, when you talk about the campaign, Biden's critics say his message was a little more than vote for me. I am not Donald Trump. That is not completely wrong, is it?
No, I don't think so. I think it was I think there are some people who were supportive of him on that basis. But I think the message was much deeper than that. I mean, it was actually a very sort of emotional message about healing the soul of the country and that, we're in troubled times and that he's the person with the experience and the understanding and the leadership and the vision and the empathy and the ability to connect with people who's able to do that. And so, you know, I think fundamentally that was a big part of his message. And I think if, you know, almost no matter who Joe Biden was running against, that would have been part of his message. Did he benefit in terms of energy and enthusiasm of his supporters because Donald Trump was on the other side? Yeah, sure. But I actually think the idea of a campaign, you've got to be authentic. You have to be true to the campaign itself, has to be true to the identity of a candidate. I think one problem that Al Gore had, and maybe even a problem that Hillary Clinton had, was there were always questions of their authenticity. There's no question with Donald Trump's authenticity. I mean, it's pretty clear. What you see is what you get. What he's thinking is what comes out of his mouth, right? So I think one of the advantages that Joe Biden had, in contrast with, the last two candidates who ran and lost for the presidency, was really that Biden also is a supremely authentic person, and so it was important to project that and sort of introduce him to the American people. And you might say, well, why did he need to be introduced to the American people? He was vice president for 8 years. At the beginning of the campaign, the comment I heard the most often was that Joe Biden was known, was well known, but not known well. And I think that's, was part of what the effort was that we particularly saw during that Democratic convention in August, which was really the kind of kick off to the final lap of the campaign.
Let me confront you with a quote of Thomas Friedman, who is the famous columnist of the New York Times. In his first reaction after the election night, he wrote, "I do not know who is the winner of the presidential election, but we do know who is the loser, the United States of America." Do you think that this is exaggerated, or was he right by...
I think it's exaggerated in a sense. I mean, obviously, Tom Friedman was one who was hoping for that massive repudiation that Van Jones talked about. So I guess from that standpoint, if you thought that's what we needed in our country, but I think it's less that a terrible loss for the United States of America, and more a mirror being held up to the United States of America. Hey, folks, you know, we are way more divided than people may have realized and recognized. And boy, we need to do something about that. I mean, that's the way I would interpret it.
And what exactly are the dividing lines?
Well, the dividing lines appear to be male and female. There was a massive, massive gender gap with Joe Biden doing even better than Hillary Clinton did among female voters. and a shift of women voters in the suburbs. Remember when I talked about people being concerned about Donald Trump's behavior and impact on their kids and so on and so forth? That I think was a significant aspect of that shift. So a big male-female divide. Trump, I haven't seen the final numbers on this, but I think we can assume that Donald Trump won men. Joe Biden overwhelmingly won the votes of women. Second is rural-urban. You know, people who live in urban areas tend to, that's why on these vote counts, when you see Donald Trump ahead in Pennsylvania, but votes still having to come in from Philadelphia, you know, Joe Biden's winning 70 to 80% of those votes. So you have in Donald Trump one, you know, you look at these maps where it colors counties in blue or red, you see seas of red. That's because so much of America actually is rural. The population centers aren't there, but that and you know, Trump was running up the numbers in those areas. So there is an urban rural divide in this country. And then the third divide, I would say, is education. And overwhelmingly, people with a college education or higher education or whatever were voting Democratic, and people who had not had that opportunity, many of whom live in rural America, were voting for Donald Trump. So those are three big. And then I think you could also say there's a bit of a split among people of faith. There's the sort of religious right that is largely a single issue voter. What they care about is banning abortion. So they see it as murder, and they care about that above and beyond all other things. So they still would end up voting for Donald Trump, notwithstanding, you know, child separation at the border and some of these other issues that Van Jones talked about, because they know he's going to appoint judges. And I'll tell you, I think his vote among that group of people was enhanced by the fact that he had three Supreme Court appointments and put three very strong, at least people who clearly were personally very, you know, strong opponents of abortion on that court. And I think that helped to motivate that block of voters. So that's another piece. But I'd say those three: men, the gender divide, urban-rural divide, and education divide. It seems to be where the divisions are happening in our country.
But given what you've just said, that would actually mean that the process of division must have started way earlier. What would you say? When did it start, actually?
Well, it probably started back in it may have started for a long, long time before that. But I think it was first reflected in our politics in the 1980 campaign when Ronald Reagan. By the way, you also could say racial lines, although there are a whole lot of white Americans who voted for Joe Biden as well. But that's another. So that's I hesitate to say racial lines. And by the way, Donald Trump improved his numbers among both blacks and Latinos in this election, which may come as a big surprise to a lot of folks, but mostly men, black men, Latino men. That's where he improved his numbers. But anyway, sorry. So back in the 1980 election, when Ronald Reagan won and the Republicans took over the Senate, that seemed to reflect a shift. And Reagan, again, did extremely well and was pushing hard in rural America, but also in suburban America. And the biggest shift that people will be analyzing and talking about for a long time in this election was the suburbs really have moved away. And I think this is in large part because of the women vote, moved away from the Republican Party. We saw that in the midterm election in 2018, and we saw it again two nights ago with the presidential election, moved away from the Republican Party and towards the Democratic Party. So, but back in 1980, you had this focus on rural America, you had the focus on the West, and you had the focus on, and that was the first time they started talking about guns and the gun culture and, you know, the Second Amendment and all that. I mean, you know, and Ronald Reagan, even though he signed the most liberal abortion law in the country as governor of California, was the first presidential candidate to unabashedly campaign as being pro-life. And so he started, you know, sort of building those or taking advantage of some of those cultural splits in America. And then I think that's just sort of continued over time since then. I have a lot of friends who served in the Reagan administration or whose parents did. And they say Ronald Reagan would be appalled at what, and Nancy Reagan as well, at what they're seeing in terms of the Republican Party. But I honestly think a lot of that started back then and just sort of accelerated. The other piece of it was when we saw the split government and in particular, an unwillingness of, you know, Mitch McConnell, who's the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, it looks like the Republicans probably will continue control of the Senate, although by one or two fewer votes. You know, Mitch McConnell famously said after the election of Obama, well, my job is to make sure this is a one-term presidency. And I also think the gridlock in our legislative process, which made it very difficult to do the kinds of things that would help improve the lives of those who felt that they were being left behind by the changes in society. That probably also contributed to it. And so, you know, you can point at a lot of things. You can point at missed opportunities on the Democratic side when for the first 2 years of Obama, the Democrats did have full control of the Senate and the House. But on the other hand, they were trying to, you know, the Obama administration was trying to keep us from tailing off into a depression and was very much focused on getting the Affordable Care Act through the healthcare piece through Congress. But then that created a backlash, which resulted in the Tea Party movement, which then maybe morphed into, you know, the Donald Trump movement. So, yeah, Donald Trump did not invent all this, but he certainly took advantage of the divisions in society and had an intuitive and an instinctual sense as to how to you know handle that from a political standpoint.
So let's stick for a minute to your former boss Barack Obama, right? Like a couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to talk to Anthony Scaramucci. He used to be the communications director in the Oval Office for 11 days altogether, I think. And he came up with an interesting theory. He said that Barack Obama himself is actually responsible for, or at least in part responsible for Donald Trump, you know, due to the fact that he oversaw that there was growing dissatisfaction and anger and fear in the population. Would you think that this was actually another reason for Donald Trump's success back in 2016, that he could march through in the U.S. elections?
I think assigning affirmative responsibility to Barack Obama for that is wrong. I do think that there may be in some parts of the country was a reaction to having a black president. That's not exactly something that Barack Obama could control. And I would hope that the next comment that Scaramucci made would be to then also talk about the Republican Senate and the strategy of blocking any effort to deal with immigration reform or, you know, the kinds of policy changes that were being pushed to try to address some of these systemic problems.
These are animals.
Oh, look at my African American over here.
A well-educated black has a tremendous advantage over a well-educated white. A black may think that they don't really have the advantage. If I was starting off today, I would love to be a well-educated black.
They don't look like Indians to me, and they don't look like Indians to Indians.
Pocahontas? Is it offensive? Oh, really? Oh, I'm sorry about that. Pocahontas?
I think she's as Native American as I am, okay?
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists.
So John, Trump's fans are not the only white old men. He was also supported by working class people and also by migrants. What's your explanation for that?
Well, sure. I mean, working class people, I think we've talked about in this. On the migrants, I understand that the only migrants who can vote are citizens. And there are two dynamics at work here. One, His support among Latinos in Florida. Well, the Latino population in Florida is largely Cuban, of a Cuban extraction, and largely people from families who fled to Florida to escape Castro. And I think that group was very, many of them, certainly the older people, maybe not so much the younger people, were very angry at the Obama administration for opening up relations to Cuba. One of the first things Trump did when he came in was shut that down. And the other thing was his appeal by, in effect, attacking Joe Biden as a socialist, which he decidedly is not. In fact, he ran against the Democratic Socialist and beat him in the primaries. But those, you know, relentless attacks on Biden as a socialist, particularly in the parts of South Florida where you had people from Cuba and people from Venezuela who are citizens and can vote, that had an impact. And so I think that's part of the explanation for that particular vote. Now, the Latino community in large, and also maybe perhaps even some of the Asian Pacific community, but particularly the Latino community, you know, people say, well, how is it, given the comments that you just played on the tape, you know, how is it that, you know, Donald Trump gets, you know, 35% of that vote, as opposed to, you know, why isn't that more reflective of what, you know, how the Black community tends to vote? And I think part of the answer is threefold. Number one, you're talking about Latino citizens, and a lot of Latinos who came into this country legally and, you know, waited in line and did everything they needed to do to get their citizenship are angry about non-citizens who come in illegally and in effect create a presumption that anyone who is of Latino extraction probably came in here illegally. So there's a little bit of an anger on that. The second thing, the second aspect to that is a lot of Latinos are conservative. They're socially conservative. They're small business people. They're pro from a religious standpoint. They are you know, anti-abortion or pro-life, and so you know, that the Trump message or candidly any, you know, even mainstream now Republican, you know, message plays to that. And so so I think the combination of those things explains why he got as big a percentage of that vote. And then I'd also just note that Joe Biden was never particularly, Hillary Clinton was always stronger with the Latino voters than Joe Biden was. Joe Biden was extremely strong with Black voters, but Bernie Sanders won most of the Latino vote in the primaries. So I would just point that out as well.
I guess it was the biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan.
Obamacare covers very few people.
The fake media goes, Donald Trump has changed his stance on China. I haven't changed my stance.
Now, the Paris Agreement, they all say it's non-binding. Like hell, it's non-binding.
It's all a phony deal, this whole impeachment scam, to try to undermine the 2020 election.
We heard a couple of quotes from Donald Trump from the last 4 years. And for me, President Trump hasn't only changed the United States, he has also changed the political culture. And my question is, to be a successful politician, is it nowadays really enough to be like him, to lie, to be so direct, sometimes vulgar, and always aiming for confrontation? Is this a role model?
No. I think it is quite unique to Donald Trump. Now, I don't think Trumpism goes away after this election, even if Joe Biden is able to hang on and win. I think Donald Trump will end up with the Trump Broadcasting Network or what have you. And I think a lot of particularly in the Republican Party, I mean, he has such a hold on, you know, a good 2/3 of the political base of the Republican Party. Maybe even more than that. I mean, he probably has 90% approval rating among Republicans, that you will see in Republican primary politics, there will be candidates who will be trying to emulate that, but without some of the behavioral or some of the comments that, such as the ones that you played earlier, that really do turn off a lot of voters, including Republican voters and moderate voters, and that's what we've seen in the suburbs. But I think it's I think we may see, we will see even within the Republican Party in the next presidential primary, which will begin the day after this thing is decided, we will see, I think, some candidates trying to emulate that sort of, articulating that tough division-oriented approach, and others trying to say, to quote from George H.W. Bush, we need a kinder, gentler approach. And that's going to be a real battle within the Republican Party. But I think fundamentally for people to get elected, that isn't necessarily the way to go. And the proof in that pudding is that every time someone tried to, in 2016, during the Republican primaries, every time someone tried to get in the, basically get down and start throwing mud at Donald Trump, they got destroyed. That happened to Marco Rubio. It happened to Chris Christie during the primaries. It's very, very interesting. So I think you're going to see, it's not that people are looking for that or want that, but I do think that approach will continue to be, a very powerful approach within Republican Party primary politics. And it'll be very interesting to see how that nomination process evolves. On the Democratic side, I don't think you're going to see much of that at all.
So we've been talking a lot about the divided nation now, and we have gained very interesting insights. We would like now to move on and have a look at the future. What is going to happen during the next days and weeks, so to say? So before this election, many critics warned that there could be riots in the case of close results. And we have seen them now, actually. In fact, in Michigan and Arizona, Trump voters have started protests because they want to stop the counting of votes. That's really astonishing.
Well, they're a little confused because they want to keep the votes being counted in Arizona and Nevada, but they want to stop the votes from being counted in Georgia and Pennsylvania. Yes. I think they need to get a little bit of a consistent message going on there.
It's about
the Biden approach is whether I'm ahead or whether I'm behind, we need to count every vote.
Yeah. But are you worried regarding these riots? Do you think that this could be only the start of a dynamic that can get really explosive in the end?
Well, first of all, I really reject, and we hear this all in the media, the characterization of these as riots. I lived through the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. Those were riots. There were over 60 people shot, killed in the riots, beaten. There were thousands of small businesses that were destroyed. There were fires all over Los Angeles. I lived through 1968 in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination. We had cities literally burning throughout the United States. Those were riots. What we see happening now is small clusters of people, unfortunately descending into violence, violence that, you could have people that perhaps it's from the right, perhaps from the left. My suspicion is a lot of times it's people that don't care about the politics and are just taking advantage of the situation to break a window and steal some things. So, those are not riots. Those are instances of looting and damage. It's inexcusable. It's unacceptable. But I think we have to be really cautious, and particularly not just in the United States, but in around the world, not to take images that may be broadcast on the media or in social media and just assume that is what is happening all over the place. It may not even be what's happening three blocks away from where those pictures are being taken. So, do I expect there to be people in the streets protesting? Yeah, we had that during Bush v. Gore. That's for sure is going to happen. I expect people are going to be protesting all the way through the inauguration. I mean, unfortunately, when the president comes out and declares this election as being fraudulent, it's basically an invitation to his supporters to believe that if he loses and Joe Biden wins, that's somehow illegitimate. And that's very unfortunate. But I think regardless, you're going to see protests of whoever wins on election day, I mean on inauguration day. So that's sort of where we are. I certainly hope that we don't even have these small incidences of violence, but I do think that the protests and that have devolved in certain parts. First of all, the protests have been overwhelmingly peaceful throughout this, in the post George Floyd era, all the way through. And secondly, to the extent that they have had incidents of looting and all, that's very, it appears to be fairly isolated. And don't confuse the images of that to what's happening across America.
So the question is just, in political terms, what will happen during the next days?
Well, what will happen is we're going to count votes. The Trump administration, the Republicans are going to file lawsuits, or not the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, and the Republicans are going to file lawsuits to try to stop the vote counting or throw out ballots in places where they fear that they're going to run behind or are running behind. The Biden campaign will work to counter those lawsuits and perhaps file other lawsuits to keep the counting going until all votes are counted. That's what we're going to see. And at the end of the day, these lawsuits will be resolved. They're all going to be handled on an expedited basis. Votes will be counted. Some votes will not be counted, but votes for the most part are going to be counted. And elections will be certified. But my sense is it'll be, I'm hopeful that within, just looking at the numbers coming in here, that within certainly 72 hours, maybe a little longer, maybe 96 hours, so say 4 days, we will know for sure, at least on the preliminary vote counts, which candidates have won which states. And we will know for sure who at that point is over 270 electoral votes, which is the magic number to be president. And then there will probably be a continuation of lawsuits challenging, some of those results, and probably in 4 or 5 states, the states that have been extremely close. I would remind folks that in 2016, you know, Donald Trump won the election because he won Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania collectively by about 75,000 votes. He won Pennsylvania by about 40,000 votes. He won Michigan by about 10,000 votes, and he won, Wisconsin by about 20,000 votes. And the lead that Biden has in both Michigan and Wisconsin is actually bigger than the margin that Trump won those states by in 2016. But that's what I think will end up happening. And, you know, yeah, there'll probably be protests during the times when these court battles are taking place around the counting and then around the courts themselves. We'll certainly see that. That's, you know, part of what we have in the United States of America. So I expect it to be kind of messy in the next few weeks, but we will have a resolution. I think that's important for people.
But do you think that a kind of smooth transition between Trump and Biden is still possible or impossible?
No, I think a smooth transition is possible. I think, it's interesting. Donald Trump has given every indication that if he goes, he'll go kicking and screaming, but he'll go. And I think that there will certainly be some moments of awkwardness. I don't anticipate the kind of smooth transition we had between, you know, say George W. Bush and Barack Obama, which is probably the gold standard for transitions and one that Barack Obama tried to deliver to the Trump folks in 2016. I don't expect it to be that smooth, but it'll work. We will have a peaceful transfer of power, unquestionably. And we may have some noise from the guy going out the door, but we will have if Biden wins, we will have a peaceful transfer of power for sure.
So the transition is one thing. The other thing is that the next president actually has to heal the wounds, so to say. He has to bring the divided parts of the United States together. He has to reconcile them in a way. So what do you think? Is Joe Biden actually the right man to do so?
I think he is absolutely the right man to do so. I mean, first of all, to the extent we talk about, you know, working men and women, in the United States, that Joe Biden grew up as a working class kid in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He understands that's his world. He's probably more comfortable in that world than he is in the, you know, Harvards and Yales of the world, right? And in fact, I heard him in one of his closing argument speeches saying, you know, it's time we had a president who wasn't educated at a Harvard or a Yale, and that's which we haven't had in quite some time, actually, or an Ivy League institution, because Trump went to Penn. So I think from that standpoint, I also think just tonally, I think this is a guy who, as much as there is anger and dispute, and you can have members of Congress who hate one another from different sides of the party, but one thing they all seem to agree on is they like Joe Biden. You know, he's a decent human being. He is empathic. He's they like dealing with him. He listens. He hears their concerns. He tries to reach to a resolution. So I think he absolutely is, and this is maybe the strongest thing going for him, besides all his experience, is that he absolutely is the right person, probably the best person we could have at this moment to try to reach across the political divide. I don't expect that, you know, magically everything's going to be healed and turned around, but he can at least begin that process. I think he is absolutely the right person to do that.
But Trump, what needs to happen, and I use this famous Donald Trump phrase now, what needs to happen to make America really great again?
Well, I mean, as Joe Biden and others have said, we are a great country. And I think what the most important thing for us to do is to sort of show the rest of the world that we can, you know, continue to make our democracy work. I would remind you of Winston Churchill's comment that democracy is the worst form of government and the messiest form of government, except for all the others. We need to do that. And I think we need to address some of our underlying systemic challenges that we have. That includes systemic racism. It includes the reality that a lot of working people in the United States have been left behind by the rapid pace of globalization and technological change. And we've got to address that. And I think we need from our leaders, we need someone who really will listen to people and respond to them in a genuine way, not just in, you know, some political pablum. And I think that's, I think a lot of people who voted for Joe Biden, that's why they voted for him, because they think he's that guy. I think the more we can re-engage with the rest of the world, the days of America being the world's policeman, those are over. But I think we can re-engage with the rest of the world, collaborate with our allies, re-engage in the multilateral institutions that are so important to, you know, the second half of the 20th century in terms of our peace and prosperity and growth, and sort of extend a hand out to our allies and also to the developing world. I think that's another important part of keeping America great in the sense of what great really means.
So I used this famous Donald Trump phrase. I asked you what really needs to happen to make America great again. And perhaps that's the time to talk now about cliches and phrases. Our listeners already know. In this podcast, we want to take a different view. We want to get away from cliches. That's why we have a small section with which we want to break some of the cliches. We call it, in a mixture of German and English, in a Denglish way, we call it the Flop Five.
The Flop Five.
So, John, it's about five sentences, five cliches that you don't want to hear no longer. Tell us, what is your first cliché?
Well, the first one is this idea that all Californians are superficial. And I think you get that in movies and TV, just surfer dude kind of thing, or people who care more about their looks than anything else. But in point of fact, Californians are dynamic, interested, interesting people. I think, honestly, it's a great reason for LA and Berlin to be sister cities, because I think Californians are a lot like Berliners. They love the outside. They love people. They're high energy. So let's get rid of that Californians are superficial thing.
Well, after this conversation, I will definitely underline that. So let's come to the second flop.
Baseball is boring. Now, I hear that from Germans. They go, oh, my God, you just sit there and you watch and you wait for the pitch and the bat. You know, we just had a World Series. Of course, my home team, the LA Dodgers, won the World Series. But baseball is, I think, the most suspenseful sport that we have. When you're waiting, it's a 3-2 count. You're waiting for that pitch that's either going to walk someone to load the bases or be a strike that someone will swing at and miss, or a ball that they might hit as a home run. And you see the tension in the pitcher and the tension in the batter, and you know it's all coming down to those two people. I'll tell you, it's one of the most suspenseful and exciting sports there is. And plus, it's a great way to spend an afternoon drinking a beer and eating a Wurst.
Okay, great idea. And next time we come and visit you and go together to a baseball match. So the third cliche, John.
Third cliche is that Americans can't play foosball. Now,
right.
And I mean German foosball. Well, I don't know. My two daughters, Taylor and Haley, they played on the Hertha club team. And there were several games where they scored the winning goals. And then they also were co-captains of their team at, Berlin-Brandenburg, BBIS, Berlin-Brandenburg International School. And their team with some other great players won the championship, the independent school championship, for 2 years running. So I don't know. I saw those two American girls do pretty well. But beyond that, particularly girls soccer in the United States of America, I think is the fastest growing sport. And particularly here in California, where you can play it all year round. It is you hear about the soccer moms. Well, I'm a soccer dad.
Well, I would personally never underestimate Americans playing foosball, and especially women's foosball. So let's come to the fourth flop.
The Germans are very serious. I mean, I will tell you, the perception of that a lot of Americans have about Germans is that you guys are like way too serious, don't have a sense of humor. And that's just completely wrong. And in fact, one of the things that struck me when I first came over on Ambassador is, you know, people, I would make jokes, people would laugh at them. Now, probably just because I was ambassador, they maybe weren't that funny. But the point is, what I've noticed is that Germans have a great sense of humor and are a lot of fun and aren't, while you're serious about what you do, you're in your personal lives, you're just not at all too serious and a lot of fun and very engaging. And I try to do everything I can to sort of knock that cliche out of the idea that a lot of Americans have.
And the last cliche, the fifth one.
The radio is dead.
Podcast is alive.
Look what we're doing here. Look at this podcast. Look at the, in fact, I think the with the evolution of radio into podcasts and the fact that people are, you know, engaging more and more in different modes of transportation, music, all of that. I think radio is going to have a real resurgence, in fact. And so thank you for including me in this.
So this is so nice. We were discussing the United States elections, and now we are discussing football, radio, women's football, and things like that. It has been really great. Thank you for that. We have to come to an end now. Time has been running so quickly, and we want to thank you so much for having been our guest. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It was my great, great pleasure. Ich freue mich sehr, mit Ihnen hier zu sein und herzlichen, herzlichen Dank.
Das war toll. Das ist nämlich jetzt für mich auch schon das Signal, dass ich nämlich wieder zum Deutschen zurückswitchen darf. Wir bedanken uns auch bei unseren Hörerinnen und Hörern, dass sie zugehört haben. Und wer Lob oder Kritik hat, darf uns das bitte mitteilen und kann uns gerne schreiben unter der E-Mail-Adresse daspolitikteil@zeit.de. Und in der nächsten Woche, Marc, sind wir beiden hier wieder am Start. Und wer bis dahin Lust hat, noch weitere Podcasts zu hören, der möge sich bitte einschalten bei unserem täglichen Nachrichtenpodcast namens Was jetzt, der sogar zweimal on air geht.
Und jeder Gast von uns, lieber John Emerson, bekommt auch ein kleines Geschenk, ein kleines Souvenir. Es gibt eine Podcast-Tasse, eine Tasse aus dem Fanshop vom Politikteil. Die bringen wir dann einfach mit, wenn wir nach Amerika kommen, um gemeinsam ein Baseballspiel zu schauen. und können dann aus der Podcast-Tasse entweder Kaffee trinken oder noch ein bisschen Bier. In jedem Fall gibt es die auch in unserem Fanshop, die Credits zu dem Fanshop und den Link, den gibt es in der Folgenbeschreibung. Wir möchten uns ganz herzlich bei unserem Produktionsteam bedanken, bei den wunderbaren Kollegen der Pool Artists und bei allen Kollegen von Zeit Online, die diese Folge wieder möglich gemacht haben.
Ja, und an dieser Stelle sagen wir tschüss.
Tschüss.
Das Politikteil ist ein Podcast von Zeit und Zeit Online, produziert von poolartists.de.